Are adults with a cancer diagnosis drinking alcohol?
Long COVID symptoms and death after COVID infection.
When can radiation be safely foregone in breast cancer treatment?
And the timely transfer of people with stroke to the appropriate hospital.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm pretty passionate about this notion of getting people who have had a stroke to the right place to receive treatment. So I'm hoping that you're okay with starting with that one.
Absolutely. So this is in JAMA, and it looks at what's called door-in, door-out times for inter-hospital transfer of patients with stroke. Patients have better outcomes when they receive care at a regional stroke center. And so when a patient presents to a hospital that doesn't have all the facilities, we want to get them to a regional stroke center as quickly as possible. From the time they hit the hospital door at the local hospital to when they get out the door towards the other center should be less than 120 minutes. This study looked at over 108,000, almost 109,000 patients who were transferred from over 1,900 different hospitals here in the United States. Of those, about two-thirds had an acute ischemic stroke. The other third had a hemorrhagic stroke. Overall, the median time was 174 minutes. Only about 27% met the criteria that is had the transfer done within 120 minutes. What things were associated with a longer time or an older individual, being female, being African-American or Hispanic? What was associated with a shorter time was if the emergency medicine system personnel notified the hospital ahead of time, went to the patient's house or wherever they were, thought that there might be a stroke, called ahead to the hospital and say, hey, we think we have a stroke. Then the hospital was better at getting them out in 120 minutes. But by the way, majority of individuals aren't brought in by the EMS team. They're brought in by a local car. So this tells us we still have some work to do.
That was very circumspect there at the end. I would be a little bit more pejorative rating performance. I would also note that there are some people who are really quite a long distance from a regional stroke center.
This was door in, door out. And so you're right. If there's a long transport time, that also adds to the delay of treatment. Sometimes, Elizabeth, transportation in an outside hospital isn't easy either because they may not have beds.
It's also sounding to me like this is yet one more thing that we're going to drop into the lap of EMS, because just like initiation of different kinds of medications and assessments in the field, sounds like we're going to be saying, hey guys, can you call ahead?
That is one area that we can certainly impact care. But as I mentioned, a third of these individuals didn't arrive by ambulance, they arrived by private vehicles. And so we still need to work on that group as well.
Let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. I said, when can radiation be safely foregone in terms of breast cancer treatment? I would just say that I do a monthly podcast with the head of the Cancer Center at Hopkins, and one trend that I see a lot emerging is this notion of modifying radiation treatment with regard to its utility in cancer treatment as a whole. In this case, they were taking a look at, should we use radiotherapy after breast-conserving surgery to reduce the risk of local recurrence of breast cancer? I became educated by this paper because I knew that the algorithm with regard to characterization of breast cancer is actually pretty complicated. And this one shows me that it's even more complicated than I knew about. They did a prospective cohort study looking at women who were at least 55 years of age, had undergone breast conserving surgery for T1N0, small tumor size, grade one or two, keep going, luminal A subtype breast cancer. That is defined as estrogen receptor positivity of greater than or equal to 1%, progesterone receptor positivity of greater than 20%, negative human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, and a new one for me, the Ki-67 index of less than or equal to 13.25%. That's an immunohistochemical analysis, this Ki-67. And what they were looking at was, all right, if we forego radiation in these women, what is our local recurrence in the ipsilateral breast? After 5 years of enrollment, recurrence was reported in overall 2.3% of the patients. Breast cancer occurred in the contralateral breast in 1.9% of the patients, and recurrence of any type in 2.7%. So the authors conclude that the incidence of this local recurrence at 5 years is low in this circumstance of omitting radiotherapy, which of course has its own set of consequences.
Elizabeth used a couple of medical terms for people that may not be familiar. Ipsilateral breast means the same breast as the initial cancer, and contralateral means the other breast. You're absolutely right. We're trying to identify women that are going to have a low risk of recurrence, and therefore they're unlikely to benefit from radiation therapy. They'll suffer the side effects, but really not benefit from it. There were a couple of things they used: age over 50, a small tumor, and no metastasis. The other four markers, three of them we routinely measure: estrogen, progesterone, and HER2. As you mentioned, there's one other cell marker called Ki-67, and that's the only additional one that we can assess who's at low risk and avoid the side effects. So I actually think knowing that we can avoid radiation therapy in this woman is a very positive finding.
Me too. And I think we're going to further characterize lots of different cancers in this way so that we can avoid the radiation if that's possible.
Agreed.
Okay, so now you're going to treat two of them about COVID.
We're going to talk about death rate after COVID, and then we're going to talk about long COVID symptoms. Let's talk first about death rate. What happens after people get discharged from the hospital? I mean, they've had a viral infection, are they still at risk of having a mortal event? And to put it in perspective, let's compare it to another viral infection. Let's compare it to flu, for example. They looked at almost 900,000 Medicare patients who were discharged from the hospital after either COVID infection. They compared it with 56,000 people that were discharged from the hospital with the flu. In the first 6 months, the risk of death after being successfully treated was almost 20%. In fact, it was about twice as high than it was with the flu. They looked at 30 days, 60 days, and 6 months, and at all points, the risk of dying after COVID infection was 2 to 3-fold higher than it was following the flu. Most of that death occurred in the first 30 days. And they also looked at hospital readmissions and determined that almost a fourth of those individuals got readmitted to the hospital over the course of 180 days.
Let's just mention that that's in the BMJ. What about underlying comorbidities?
What I can say is they matched the patients with flu and COVID. So they had just about the same comorbidities. The readmission rate was the same in 180 days. And as you know, they have subsequent infections, they have cardiovascular disease, they have sepsis, pneumonia, other issues.
What does Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report tell us about this?
Okay, well, it did not look at the death rate, but it looked at the long COVID rate. And they looked over a one-year period between June of 2022 and June of 2023. There's still a significant number of individuals that have long COVID symptoms, but that prevalence decreased from about 7.5% to 6%, just among the overall U.S. population. Here's what I was surprised at, Elizabeth, is that the individuals that are most likely to suffer long COVID are people in the middle age. Individuals less than 18, over 60, they're less likely to have long COVID symptoms. Even though the rate decreased somewhat, those that experienced a decline were those under 60 years of age. Why is the long COVID rate down? Well, because people have been exposed to COVID before. It's probably less virulent strains, vaccination rates. We still haven't completely done away with long COVID symptoms.
Yet one more reason to pay attention to these recommendations that probably all of us need to get a booster in the fall. And there's one that's actually matched to the strain that's predominant.
That's right. A new strain out, about 20% of the new COVID infections are a new strain. And this vaccine will be available in September.
Okay. Let's turn to our final one, which is in JAMA Network Open. And this was a little bit of a surprise to me. This was looking at alcohol consumption among adults with a cancer diagnosis in the U.S. All of Us research program. That's one that was undertaken by the NIH. They looked at data from May in 2018 to January of 2022. They were able to identify 15,000 plus participants who reported a cancer diagnosis and 1,839 among a subset who underwent treatment within the past year of the baseline survey. They found that among these 11,800 plus cancer survivors, almost 78% were current drinkers, 13% of those folks exceeded moderate drinking, just shy of 24%, one in five, binge drinking, 38% in hazardous drinking. They defined those all. Moderate is greater than or equal to two drinks, binge greater than or equal to six on a single occasion, and hazardous using the criteria called Audit C, which is a score greater than or equal to three for women or four for men. I think a little bit concerning, especially because there are some cancers that are clearly associated with alcohol use.
Yeah, so think about it for a second. In the U.S., we have over 18 million cancer survivors right now. Besides getting treated, they want to say, what can I do to help prevent cancer in the future? Well, this is a modifiable risk. Alcohol is associated with oral cavity cancer, pharyngeal cancer, cancer of the larynx, esophagus, colorectum, liver, and female breast cancer as well. And we know that people that continue drinking have worse outcomes during treatment. They have decreased effectiveness of the chemotherapy. They're more likely to have recurrences. So the fact that 40% of individuals that are cancer survivors have hazardous drinking habits means we need to get the message out to them.
I would also just note that almost 77% of these folks were non-Hispanic white in this study. Almost 76% were diagnosed when the patient was between 18 and 64 years of age. Young people who were being diagnosed with these cancers.
And Elizabeth, even though this included a large number of Caucasians, and Hispanics were less likely to drink after a cancer diagnosis than Caucasians, they were more likely to be binge drinkers or hazardous. So the message is, if you can avoid alcohol, do so. If you do drink, please limit it. For women, one drink or less per day, and for men, no more than one or two per day.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up. Make healthy choices.